July 19th. Another 10:05 start, another sleepless night. The Yanks have already lost to Tampa Bay. And when Tech breaks a 1-1 tie with a 3-run bomb off J.J. Poots in the 8th, it looks like we'll be 6 back. Arroyo's thrown brilliantly, striking out 12, including 11 straight outs by strikeout at one point. And the only run Seattle scored was due to some typical sloppy fielding. Because Schilling went so deep yesterday, the pen is rested. Embry and Timlin set up and combined to let in a cheapie, abetted by Bill Miller winging a double play ball past Bellhorn into right field. But Timlin gets a big strikeout with 2 in scoring position to end the inning. Falk comes in to close. With 1 down, he gives up a solo shot to Miguel Olivo. "They sure don't make it easy on us," I tell Steph and my nephews. All the other adults have long since gone to bed. Edgar Martinez is next. At 41, he can't run, so all Falk has to do is throw him 3 low changes and he's meat. Instead, Falk throws him an 88-mile-per-hour fastball over the heart of the plate. Edgar's been killing this pitch since he was 15 and doesn't miss. Johnny and Kapler both leap at the wall in right center, but it's gone. The M's have gone back-to-back, and the game's tied. "Unbelievable," I say. The boys are angry and want Francona to take him out, but we don't have anyone else. Embry, Timlin, Falk, this is our A-team. Falk gets the last out on a long fly to right, then struggles so much in the 10th that the boys quit. It's 1:15 in the morning, and we have to get up early tomorrow. Overall, Falk throws 41 pitches. After starting the year 10 for 10 in save opportunities, he's 4 for his next 9, and that shaky streak started against Seattle, that Sunday game when Raul Ibanez took him into the pen, and McCarty bailed him out in extras with a walk-off job. In the 11th, McCarty, leading off, gets on an error. Kapler bunts too hard down third, and they get the force at second. Again, we've got no small ball. Kapler takes second anyway on a wild pitch, but Bellhorn looks at a very wide strike 3, and Johnny flies to left. Since Falk's gone too, we have to bring in Laskanik. He gets behind Olivo 3-1, and Olivo singles through the hole. Dave Hansen wants to bunt him across. Curtis does the job for him, walking him. Then, in what must be seen as team play in Japan, on the very first pitch, Ichiro bunts them over. Francona intentionally walks Randy Wynn and pulls the infield in for Brett Boone. On 0-1, Boone hits a fly to left center. It's deep enough to score the run, so the fielders ignore it and jog in as the ball clears the wall for a walk-off grand slam. It's 1:45, and I'm so pissed off that I'm glad they lost, because they suck. See, it's not we now, it's they. The loss is so deranging that for a few minutes I have to separate myself from the team. They didn't hit or field for Arroyo. The 3-run shot by Tech was a gift. All they needed was 6 outs against the worst team in the league. I want to blame someone, and the obvious target is Falk. But I know that closers blow games. Even Eric Gagne blew one the other day. And while it's true that the pen hasn't looked good lately, Theo hasn't helped matters by picking up retreads like Anderson, Nelson, and Laskanik. Mendoza, who should be covering some of these middle innings, is taking up a roster spot but may never pitch another meaningful at-bat in the majors. But Theo didn't give up back-to-back jacks. It's just a loss. A brutal, late-night, extra-inning loss of a game we should have won. A game we needed, since we need all of them now. And there's nothing to do but eat it and go on. July 20th. It's also the kind of loss that makes you nervous the next time the game's on the line. And tonight we get a nightmarish rerun of last night, when Lowe has to leave early with a blister, and Seattle chips away at our 8-1 lead until it's 9-7 in the 9th. With 2 on and no out, and Falk sweating buckets. Seattle has 18 hits, including 4 from Ichiro, along with 4 stolen bases, but has left 14 on. Because of last night, I don't believe in Falk at all. He could give up another walk-off job to Boone here, and I just shrug, because I'm still pissed off at him, at them. The Yanks have already won, so a loss would drop us 8 back, and I think fuck it, 7, 8, 9, it doesn't matter. If we keep losing on the road like this, we don't deserve to be in any race. Falk doesn't try to nibble like last night. He leads with his fastball to get ahead, then goes exclusively to the change. He strikes out Boone, strikes out Edgar, strikes out Bucky Jacobson for the game. For an instant, as the ump rings up Jacobson, I'm excited. But I cool off just as quickly. We barely squeaked this one out, and it should have been a laugher after an 8-run fourth. David Ortiz with a 3-run bomb, then Manny going back-to-back. Same problem as always, no middle relief. Liscanic let two of Lowe's runners score. In his one inning, Timlin gave up a run. Nelson allowed two runs and only retired one man. Mendoza sat on the bench and watched. Kim was in Columbus with the Paw Sox. I have no idea where Theo was. July 21st. I email Steve. Thanks for the tickets for tomorrow and the weekend. This 6-game homestand is crucial after the ugly road trip. A bad time to stumble since the Yanks are faltering as well. Kevin Brown pitched against the Paw Sox last night and looked good, so he may be back sooner than we might wish.
Last night's win was just about as ugly as they get. I'll take 500 on the road, especially on the West Coast, but we had a chance to come back 4-2 and in much better shape. I'm reading Moneyball now, and it's really a jaw-dropping book. Lewis asserts, with no reservations whatever, that Art Howe is no more than the ventriloquist dummy on Billy Bean's knee, which leads me to wonder if that is now true in Boston, i.e., if Terry Francona is the dummy on Theo Epstein's knee. And if Epstein is following the Bean paradigm, then our team is in middling good shape, assuming Theo is planning trades before the deadline. Bean feels good if he can go into the second half of the season 6 or less back. Still, I don't buy into everything the book suggests, either from the standpoint of strategy and certainly not from the standpoint of business morality.
My main argument with Moneyball is that the modest success of the A's is based on Mulder, Hudson, and Zito, and it's pretty much a matter of luck that they came up at the same time and fulfilled the scouts' expectations. So many prospects don't, but these three did. Otherwise, the no-running, no-fielding, big OBP club has trouble scoring when it doesn't hit 3-run home runs. Hey, just like us. Billy Bean's always crowing about his genius, but look at the Twins, who've put together a better, steadier club with even less money. They've lost core guys like Eric Milton and A.J. Pierzynski, yet they keep on keeping on. And for a solid club that knows how to play the game, I'll take the small ball Angels any day, even with their terrible starters.
I disagree. They were a certain type of ball player, picked for talent and affordability. And in the case of Zito, the scouts hated him. He was Bean's pick. All that aside, this year's Red Sox team is a sick entity right now, and I hate it. I keep going back in my mind to one of those games versus the Angels. We're down by at least 3 runs and maybe 5. There are 2 out, and the Angels' pitcher is struck wild. There are 2 on for us in Pokey at the plate. He puts on a heroic at-bat, finally drawing a walk to load them for Johnny Damon, who swings at the first pitch he sees, the first motherfucking pitch he sees, and lines out to center. The fielder didn't even have to take a step. That's just deer in the headlights baseball. Something going on around here. What it is ain't precisely clear, but I'm not loving it.
It's the 21st. Meaning Theo's got 10 days to close his deals. I think we've got to land a quality arm, probably a starter who lets Arroyo be the middle relief ace, a huge advantage since no one out there has a Mendoza-type guy, and Nelson and Anderson are fire starters. But I'm not holding my breath. First pitch hitting is a killer. But Johnny obviously thought the guy was going to groove one to try to get ahead, like Fulk last night. Any of those guys swings at that 88-mile-per-hour double-A quality fastball, and it's see ya.
I thought of that, but it's still a bonehead move. One of the things Lewis points out in Moneyball, courtesy of Bill James and the Sabermetrics guys, is that batting average goes up 75 points if a batter takes the first pitch, and that pitch is a ball. He also reminds the reader of Boggs, who always took the first pitch, and Hatteberg, who mostly does.
What hurts is watching all these opportunities go by. And that's also a product of the OBP thing. Speaking of guys who always took one, Roberto Clemente, the anti-Nomar. Nomar is a notorious first-pitch hitter, regardless of the game situation. just as the great one never swung at a first pitch. Do you believe we're tied for the wild card? Seems impossible the way we've been playing. Almost wish the D-Rays would reel off another 11 straight to shake things up. Somnambulism, baby, that's where we're at. At least tonight I won't have to stay up till 1:45 to watch us tank. No, only till the sixth inning, when Tejada breaks a 3-3 tie with a bases-loaded single to left. Pedro, who's been missing his spots all night, nearly gets out of it. But Johnny's throw on Javi Lopez's short sack fly is weak and up the first base line, and it's 6-3. Earlier, Johnny misjudged a Tejada liner into a triple, leading to their first three runs. And later, in a wacky play, he relays a David Newhand shot to the wall and center toward Bill Miller, who started bizarrely at second with Uke at third. But Manny, in another classic Manny move, intercepts it, diving, then relays it to Bellhorn, who started at short. And by the time Mark guns it to Tech, Newhand's in with the easiest inside-the-park homer you'll ever see. It's 8-4, and the faithful boo. Melvin Mora follows with a single, and Petey's done. Mendoza throws a third of an inning and gives up two hits, and Malaska has to save him. Then Jimmy, I'm the boss, Anderson comes on and gives up his usual two runs before recording an out. It's a 10-4 final, and with the Yanks stomping Toronto, we drop to 8 back. The only sock who comes out of this one looking good is Gabe Kapler, who made a tumbling catch in right in the fourth, then hit a 3-run shot onto the monster to tie it at 3. The rest of the team looked like they'd gotten about 3 hours of sleep, which they did since their plane got in at 3 in the morning, shades of opening day. Meanwhile, lots of roster moves right before game time. Pokey to the DL with a pulled ribcage muscle. Euclid up from Pawtucket. Joe Nelson down, Malaska up. And to have a backup for Nomar, Theo picked up journeyman shortstop Ricky Gutierrez from the Iowa Cubs. Ladies and gentlemen, your 2004 Iowa Red Sox.
July 22nd. I email Stewart. I'm off to Los Angeles. I'm leaving this crucial homestand to your guidance, and probably a good thing. They looked so miserable last night, didn't they?
It's a day-night doubleheader today. And since Wake's scheduled to start and the Yanks are coming in tomorrow, we can't shift the rotation to cover the extra game. We don't announce a starter till late morning. Abe Alvarez, a lefty from AA Portland. Jimmy, I'm the boss, Anderson, is designated for assignment. Number 59, Abe's pipe cleaner skinny and looks about 17. He wears his cap cocked to the side like C.C. Sabathia, but throws soft fastball, topping out at 88, slow curve, change. He has trouble finding the plate in the first and gives up 3 runs, 2 on a monster shot by Tejada, who is just murdering us this series. It's hot, sweaty hot, heat stroke hot, and we're in the sun. Over the course of the game, I buy 10 bottles of water for Steph and the nephews. We squirt them in our hats and down our collars and at each other. Hey, frozen lemonade! Hey, sports bar! Ortiz hits 2 triples, a kind of miracle, but doesn't score either time. Melvin Mora lofts a shot toward the Sox bullpen that Trot has the angle on, but at the last second he gets alligator arms and shies away from the wall and it goes over. The faithful boo him. Very rare. We also boo villain Kareem Garcia every time he steps in. It's his first visit to Fenway since he jumped the bullpen wall during last year's ALCS to punch and kick a groundskeeper his buddy Jeff Nelson was already assaulting. You're a goon, Garcia, we holler. When he strikes out midway through the game, the crowd behind the O's dugout stands and jeers at him. Maybe the most satisfying moment of the day. Abe Alvarez leaves with the score 5-1. He hasn't pitched well, but he's battled. And for a double-A guy, the beefed-up O's are a tough assignment. Francona goes to a triple-A guy, Mystery Malaska, who gives up a run. Millar, who's been booed every at-bat since he hit into an early rally-killing double play, crushes a 2-run shot to bring us within 3. But in the ninth, Francona goes to Mendoza, our washed-up guy, and Mora pounds a 2-run bomb to put the game out of reach. All afternoon, we've been watching the New York-Toronto score, 0-0 in the third, the fourth, the sixth. It's been stuck in the eighth for more than an hour, as if they're purposely withholding it. Now that we've lost, it changes to a 1-0 Yankees final. We're 9 back, the deepest hole we've been in all year, and 2-6 against the O's. After the game, as we're fighting traffic on Starro Drive, and then 93 and 95, the Sox option Abe to Portland, making room for Ricky Gutierrez. Trudy wonders how much they paid him for the guest spot. Between games, Bill Miller, who went 0-5, decides to shave his head for luck like Trot and Tech and Gabe. And the league office informs David Ortiz that he's received a 5-game suspension for throwing his bats the other night in Anaheim. For the nightcap, the O's roll out their kid pitcher with a high number, number 61, Dave Borkowski. Gutierrez gets the start at short, Uke at third, McCarty in left. McCarty's a revelation. We know he's got a great glove as a first baseman and an arm that can top 90 miles per hour. In the first, he puts those together, snagging what ought to be an easy sack fly and nailing speedy leadoff man Brian Roberts at home with a perfect one-hop peg. It kills what could be a big inning, and an hour half with two down, he slices a bases-loaded single to right to give us a 3-0 lead. Wake's crafty tonight, or maybe the O's are tired. Both teams are listless, and it's a quick one. Uke hits a solo shot into the second row of M5. Timlin sets up with a 1-2-3 eighth. Then Embry gets a double play ball in the ninth and a strikeout to close it. A neat 4-0 final, and it's only 9:30. It's a win, but losing 2 of 3 to the O's before the Yanks roll in is disheartening. Like Steve said, they're miserable, and I'm miserable. And the rumors that we'll trade Nomar while we can still get something for him are more miserable still. July 23rd. The crowd around Fenway before game time is typical of a Yankee-Red Sox game. More loudmouth drunks, more shutterbugs and gawkers, more shills handing out free stuff. But at 8.5 back, it's hard to muster any showdown spirit. Call this one a grudge match, with the Sox trying to save some face. WEEI's K posters say, Schilling is thrilling, and we hope he has enough to beat retread John Lieber. Outside gate E, a guy's wearing a t-shirt that says, David Ortiz Fan Club, with a picture not of Big Poppy, but of Esther Roll as Florida in Good Times. On the back it has what I hope is a fictional quote from him. This is not hot sauce, this is not barbecue sauce, this is the Boston Red Sauce. Steph and I are the first in and man the corner for BP. A lot of the Sox have their kids with them in the outfield, wearing miniature versions of their uniforms. Jeter and A-Rod throw, and Jeter backs up till he's right beside me. He's wearing Nike spikes with the logo of the leaping Michael Jordan. Now, the way Michael Jordan hit, I ask, isn't it bad luck to wear his spikes? I wouldn't know, Jeter says dully, as if he doesn't care. After BP, we roll around to the Sox dugout. It takes a while since the aisles are clogged with newbies and Yankee fans who can't find their seats. They stop and stare at their expensive eBay tickets and then up at the poles of the grandstands, as if having difficulty reading numbers. Keep it moving, we say. We make it to Steve's seats in time for the anthem, which is live and not Memorex, as it has been in the past. The proof being the guest Irish tenor botching the words, the last twilight's gleaming, the rocket's red glares. Nice job, Dermot. As the game starts, again I have the sense of letdown. It's Friday night, a packed house, Schilling on the mound against the Yanks, but we've played so poorly lately that it's sapped the drama out of the matchup. We still chant, Balco, when Sheffield steps in, but half-heartedly. When he takes Schilling out, hooking a monster shot, all of that changes. Maybe it's a sense of fair play, honest outrage at Sheffield getting away with his steroid use, or maybe it's just hurt. But for the rest of the game, whenever Sheffield or Giambi come up, we greet them with lifetime ban, lifetime ban, and Marion Jones, Marion! Lieber's hittable, and in the second, Trot doubles in Nomar. Then Bill Miller launches one into the bullpen, and we're up 3-1. Millar tacks on a solo shot in the fourth, and with Schilling only up to 54 pitches, we're looking good. In the fifth, Mr. Schill gives up a leadoff single to Posada, then another to Matsui. Enrique Wilson flies one to left that looks like trouble, but it quails and Manny hauls it in on the track. Kenny Lofton follows with a ripped single to right. It should score the runner, except the runner's Posada. Trott fires a one-hopper to Tech. Posada beats the throw, but Tech's got the plate blocked. We can hear the plastic clack as Posada knocks into his shin guards. Tech spins and tags Posada's shoulder, and he's out. No, he's safe. Ump Tim Timmons is calling him safe. Tech looks down at the plate open-mouthed with shock. Schilling races from his backup position, pointing. Francona trots over from the dugout. The crowd's been booing the whole time, but the argument's quick and civil. Timmons laughing as if there's no way he could be wrong. Our neighbor Mason later sees the replay upstairs. He was out, he says, but it was a tough call. Yeah, I concede. You'd have to be a professional umpire to make it. The run throws Schilling off, and he loads them before overpowering Jeter, who looks lost at the plate, and getting a force on Sheffield. In the sixth, A-Rod takes Schilling to 3-2, and then fouls off a few fastballs before singling up the middle. Giambi goes to 3-2 and fouls a few over the second deck, then walks on a curveball that stays up. Terrible pitch selection. Posada goes 3-2, fouls off a couple, then singles through the right side. Bases loaded, nobody out, and Schill's pitch count is in the high 80s. He works deliberately to Matsui and gets a hard hopper to Millar at first. It should be a double play, but Millar's throw to Nomar is high and off the bag to the infield side, and Schilling doesn't get over to first fast enough. Nomar holds the ball rather than risk throwing it away. 4-3 Sox, runners at the corners. Formerly washed-up Ruben Sierra pinch hits for Enrique Wilson. Schilling has him 0-2 quickly, and Sierra has to fend off a good inside pitch with a protective swing. It's a nubber down first, a swinging bunt. Millar fields it on the run. It looks like he's got a play right in front of him at home on Giambi, but he glances back at first. Schilling's assumed he'll go home and hasn't covered, and has to eat the ball. The faithful boo. When Lofton sneaks a soft double past Millar that McCarty would have stopped, we boo harder. That's it for Schilling. A frustrating end to a promising start. Usually our defense backs him up better than this, but if he can't get a fastball past the intestinal parasite weakened Giambi, then he didn't have it anyway. Timlin comes on, and washed-up Bernie Williams rips a double into the right field corner, scoring two. 7-4 Yankees, and more booing, curses, than a disappointed, disapproving silence. When Millar comes up in our sixth, the crowd boos him lustily. He hit a home run his last at-bat, Steph points out. You can see Millar's pissed off in the on-deck circle, focused, his teeth clenched. He rocks a Paul Quantrill fastball onto the monster for his second solo shot, and when he crosses the plate, though the kids in the front row do the "we're not worthy" salam, his expression hasn't changed. In the seventh, Johnny singles, then scores on Tech's double to left center when Matsui boots the ball. Ortiz walks, and we've got first and second, nobody out, and Manny up. So far, Manny's 0-for-3 with 2 Ks, but we rise and chant his name, expecting deliverance. He grounds into an easy 6-4-3 double play, and the crowd mutters. Formerly washed-up Tom Gordon then hits Nomar in the shoulder, but Trott flies to center. Curtis Laskanik comes on in the eighth, causing some consternation, and throws a 1-2-3 inning. Then Millar, cheered now, leads off with a blast onto the monster to tie the game, his third homer of the night, and the place is louder than it's been since the playoffs. We're watching a great game. Fuck the Yankees. Fuck the standings. We stand and cheer through half of Bill Miller's at-bat, but Millar, justifiably, doesn't come out for a curtain call. Billy singles, and since he'd be the go-ahead run, Kapler pinch runs for him. With nobody out, Bellhorn needs to bunt him over. Is there anyone on the bench who can bunt better? No, not with Ricky already done and Pokey on the DL. Bellhorn fouls off two, then hits a weak grounder and has to hustle to avoid being doubled up. Simple fundamental baseball, I say. Little league baseball, Mason says. Johnny doubles. Instead of Kapler scoring, Bellhorn is held at third. We still have two shots at getting him in. But Tech, batting second for some crazy reason, chases a slider from Gordon in the dirt on 3-2, as does Ortiz, and we go to the ninth tied at 7. Folks in to hold it. After several questionable ball calls by Timmins, and no argument at all by Francona, Sheffield arcs one toward the monster that looks gone. A couple fans in the front row reach down and it hits 10 feet from the top for a double. A-Rod singles him in. It's that simple. A poor pitch by Folk, a good swing by the Mariner shortstop, the Texas shortstop, you know what I mean. It's 8-7 for Mariano Rivera in the ninth. Timmins' blown call at home has been big all game, but it's massive now. Moe has no problem getting Manny, Nomar, and Trot, leaving Kevin Millar in the on-deck circle. As he stalks back to the dugout with his bat, I call, "Great game, Kev," but his face is still clenched and he ignores me. We're 9.5 back and behind the White Sox in the wild card. That's not drama. That's desperation. July 24th. Together, the Sox and Yanks have spent over $300 million on their rosters. Is Bronson Arroyo versus Tanyan Sturts really the best they can do? Today's the family picnic, and it's raining at the beach, so all of Trudy's aunts and uncles and cousins and nieces and nephews are crammed into the one main room of the cottage to watch the game. They're lifelong New Englanders from Woonsocket and Westerly, and watching the Sox is like watching home movies. It gives them a chance to remember how Uncle Vernon rooted, optimistic all the way to the last out, or Trudy's grandfather Leonard, watching TV with the sound down because he hated the announcers, a transistor radio pressed to his ear, and he would never go to the games. We watch Arroyo get behind hitters, and get behind 2-0. I go out to shoot some hoops, and as I'm dribbling around, a shout comes up from the house next door. Fight! Fight! My nephew Sam comes tearing out. Uncle Stu, there's a bench-clearing brawl. We run inside just in time to see the replay. Arroyo hits A-Rod on the elbow with a pitch inside, nothing new. Arroyo's second in the league and hit batsman. A-Rod jaws at him right out of the box, though the pitch wasn't up or behind him. In fact, it hit him on the elbow pad. Tech says something to A-Rod. A-Rod says, "Come on," and Tech shoves him two-handed in the face, then ducks and grabs A-Rod around the upper thigh and lifts him, bullying him backwards. The whole room cheers and laughs. What kind of idiot challenges a guy in a mask and shin pads to a fight? Obviously, he's never played hockey. The bench is clear. It's a harmless scrum except for Sturts getting Gabe Kapler in a headlock from behind. A bad move when you're on the opposing team's side of the scrum. No idea how their starting pitcher ended up by our on-deck circle. But David Ortiz is nearby and won't see his teammate treated this way. He grabs Sturts and flings him to the ground. In the replay, as they fall, gravity gives Kapler some revenge as his knee lands in Sturts' crotch. Trot piles on, but by then things have settled and they're pulled apart. Tex ejected, as is A-Rod and Kapler. Sturts has a bloody scratch near his ear, but stays in the game. In the dugout, Kapler's pissed. "He grabbed me," he shouts, demonstrating. Later, I discover that Kenny Lofton's been tossed, though only he and the ump know what he did. The game's on Fox, and the idiots in the booth say that maybe this will change New Yorkers' minds about A-Rod's lack of toughness. I keep looking for evidence in the replays, because they show it 10 times. But all I see is Tech shoving him in the face and lifting him off the ground. They also say this is a case of the Red Sox frustrations boiling over, except A-Rod started it. They run a montage of Sox-Yanks brawls going back to Fisk slugging Munson after their collision at home. In every clip, the Sox are whipping their asses. When order's restored, the Sox come back over the next couple innings to take a 4-3 lead. Sturts is gone, and Juan Padilla is on. In the fifth, there's a terrible call on Johnny at second, when Enrique Wilson drops a pop-up in short right and throws late to second for the force. Johnny, who's always a gentleman, says no, and he's right. Francona comes out to argue, and no doubt he's arguing about last night's blown call at home, too, and Timmins' awful work behind the plate. Francona actually gets excited for once, swearing and spitting at the ump's feet, and gets tossed. He's in the clubhouse to watch the Yanks come back in the sixth. Wilson slices a spinning Texas leaguer over third. Posada pokes a low wall ball in his meat at second on a perfect throw by Manny. Except Bellhorn sets up too far behind second, not expecting Posada to try it, and waves at the in-between hop. Matsui doubles to put them ahead. Arroyo battles for two outs, but Cairo hits a quail off the end of the bat that floats over Bellhorn, and it's 6-4. Dave Wallace visits the mound. Bernie Williams singles. Brad Mills, as acting manager, pulls Arroyo for Liscannick. Curtis threw well last night. Today, he can't find the plate. He walks Jeter, oh, for his last million and groveling for a walk, to load them, then walks Sheffield to bring in a run. He goes full on Wilson, who singles to right, scoring two more. 9-4. He walks Posada, and that's it. He's gone. Zero innings pitched, one hit, one run, three bases on balls. And Mystery Malaska's on to face Matsui. On 3-2, Matsui takes a strike down the middle for the third out. Before this, I considered Matsui the most professional of the Yankees. But what is anyone doing taking a pitch on 3-2 with a 5-run lead? That's Bush, and even in the Bush leagues will earn you some lumps. Nomar leads off the Sox sixth with a ripped single. When Padilla goes 2-0 on trot, pitching coach Mel Stottlemyre goes to the mound to calm him down and stall. Padilla's way off the plate, as if he's afraid of lefties, and walks trot. On a 1-1 count to Millar, Torre interrupts the flow of the game by bringing in Quantrill. It's the old Cuban slowdown. But even in the Pan American games where the umps let you do anything, I can't remember two mound visits on consecutive batters in mid-count. After a 5-minute delay for warm-ups and commercials, Millar singles to load them. On 3-1, Bill Miller has a fat pitch to hit, but skies it to center for an unsatisfying sack fly. Bellhorn strokes a wall ball double, and it's 9-6. Johnny singles to left, 9-7. Because Tech got ejected, Mirabelli's batting second, and we don't have a backup catcher, so we can't pinch hit Euclid for him. Mirabelli K's, and Torre brings in Felix Heredia, who walks Ortiz to load the bases for Manny. Stottlemyre visits the mound again, their fourth visit this half inning. Heredia goes 3-2 on Manny, who's hit like crap this series, then misses with a pitch a good foot up and out, 9-8, and Nomar's up. But look, what's this? It's Joe Torre plodding out to the mound. Another 5-minute delay while Scott Proctor of the Columbus Clippers warms. Home plate ump Bruce Fromming, who's built like Violet and Willy Wonka after she turns violet and the Oompa Loompas roll her away, makes it easy for Proctor, giving him a first strike call on a ball nowhere near the zone. And after all the waiting and screwing around, Nomar's pissed and just swings at anything. Hey, Joe, the tactic worked. And strikes out to end what has to be the longest inning I've ever seen. 1 hour and 7 minutes, according to Fox's clock. While I think the Yankee-Cuban national team stuff is crap and definitely unsporting, it's legal. But it's also the home plate ump's responsibility to control the game. And in the rule book, there's a powerful clause that says the umpire can penalize any behavior that he independently deems makes a mockery of the game. The classic example is running the bases backwards. I would submit to the league office that the slowdown not only makes a mockery of the game, it makes for bad TV, since that's the only thing the league office seems to care about. Steroids? What steroids? In other sports, not only are players banned, but their team's victories are retroactively forfeited and their championships taken away, their records expunged. Just a warning, Chef, in case we ever have a real commissioner again. Ruben Sierra, career, what career? Leads off the seventh with a monster shot off Malaska to make it 10-8. The crowd in the humid room groans. I go out to the beach, where there's a little kid in a Red Sox t-shirt with a wiffle bat hitting stones into the ocean in the rain. Stone after stone. Clack, clack, clack. Finally, some perspective. The game's not about the slowdown, or the TV contract, or the groan. It's about how fun it is to swing a bat and make contact. That clean ping. Embry, who worked out of a jam in the seventh, is angry in the dugout because Mills pulled him for Mendoza. I'm horrified to see Mendoza myself, since he hasn't thrown a clutch inning since last June, including his season-long stint in the minors. Somehow, physics won't explain it, he does today, and not just one, but two of them. We go to the ninth down 10-8, facing Mo as always. He's converted 23 straight save opportunities. The Yanks are 56-0 and leading, blah, blah, blah. With two strikes, Nomar doubles on a particularly flat cutter. Rivera goes 3-1 on Trot, who crushes the next pitch to right. Get out, we yell, rising from our chairs. Sheffield goes back sideways, then backwards, crab-like, and hauls it in on the track. In any other park, it's a game-tying home run. Fenway giveth. Nomar moves over, and while we're still talking about Rivera's ineffectiveness, Millar bloops one to right, making it a one-run game. Mo's not Mo. He's missing high, missing wide, all over the place. He goes 3-1 on Bill Miller, then gives him the same flat pitch he threw Trot, and Billy gets it. That's gone, I say, and Sheffield knows it too, turning to show us his number as the ball lands in the glove of Sox bullpen catcher Dana Levangi. The Sox jump up and down at home, slapping Billy on his shaved head. For some reason, he pulls his helmet off just before he touches the plate. Maybe he wants to really feel it, to remember it forever. In the room, we're all up and shouting, trading high fives and hugging. I told you, Steph says. You did, I admit. Because he's been behind Billy all the way, even when he hit into a rally-killing double play early on. So it's a double win. A TKO by Tech and a walk-off shot by Bill Miller. Enormously satisfying. And just. And weird the way Mendoza was suddenly unhittable, where in Pawtucket the Rochester Red Wings were wearing him out. And Mo, so hittable. And wild, very much unlike him. The fight's great for ratings, too, and reinvigorates the rivalry after being down 9.5 games. As a novelist, I'd say the plot's too pat, designed for the big finish, like some of the NFL playoff games the last couple years. The more I think of it, the less I like it. I email Steve. Now I know what you're doing out there, writing scripts for Fox Baseball, a division of the International Roller Derby Association. Today's walk-off sure looked cooked. The same bad pitch to Trot and Bill Mill? Talk about a groovy situation. I swear, when Trot stepped in, he looked out at Rivera apologetically, as if this wasn't his idea. Thou shalt not lie, Christopher Trotman Nixon. But we're so desperate that we'll gladly take it and be thankful. Pay no attention to the man behind the curtain. July 25th. ESPN's showing the rubber game of the series, meaning it's an 8:05 start. It also means ESPN's built a temporary stage just past the third base dugout, and the screen that's usually at third has been moved to protect Peter Gammons, Harold Reynolds, and John Kruk. When Miguel Cairo smokes a rope right at me in BP, I realize why the screen is there. The ball's hit so on the nose that it knuckles, and I have to follow it all the way into my glove. I actually catch it in the pocket with a satisfying smack, getting a hand from the crowd and a few glances from the Yankees gathered at short. But it's hit so hard that my index finger, which sticks through the holster opening and is cushioned by at least 3 layers of leather, is numb and then tingly. How's it feel? A guy behind me jokes. Good, I say. And in a way it does. I've played a fair amount at goalie and at third base, and it's the hardest shot I've ever stopped. Here's how big the game is. Instead of the hood blimp cruising low over us like Friday night, it's the MetLife blimp. We've gone from regional to national. I get a ball that A-Rod kicks taking grounders. Then I'm off to Autograph Alley, where Oil Can Boyd is signing, accompanied by a beefy, bleached blonde guy with a bright Hawaiian shirt and 10 pounds of gold jewelry like a wrestler's manager. The can is gaunt but stylish, fringes of gray in his close-cropped hair. 1986, I say as he's signing my ball. ALCS Game 6. You were here, I was here. Thanks, Dennis. The concourse is gridlocked, and I miss the Marine Honor Guard unfurling a massive American flag that covers the monster, and then John Kerry throwing out the first pitch. Kerry Edwards' campaign aides are handing out Sox Fans for Kerry signs throughout the park, a byproduct of owner Tom Werner's support of the Democrats. I reach my seat in time for Derek Lowe's first pitch. Right from the beginning, the ump's squeezing him. Lowe has Kenny Lofton struck out, but there's no call. Lofton grounds a single to left that somehow makes it to the wall and becomes a double. Lofton takes third when Jeter, in a Zoolander stupid move, bunts him over. Sheffield hits a fly to center that's short enough for an interesting play at the plate, But Johnny waves both arms as if he doesn't see it. Bellhorn's going out. Kapler streaking in from right. Kapler dives, an instant too late. Lofton scores. Sheffield jogging ends up at first. A-Rod nubs one that Bill Miller has no play on. Then Lowe bounces one that just nicks Posada on the foot. Andrew tosses me the traitorous ball. Matsui hits a fly deep enough to get Sheffield home. Bernie Williams flies to Manny, a nice running catch in the corner. But it's 2-0 Yanks, and Lowe is red-cheeked and unhappy. Jose Contreras' ERA at Fenway this year is over 20, and he shows us why. Johnny legs out an infield single, then moves to second when a pickoff throw gets past Tony Clark. Contreras quickly walks Bellhorn and Ortiz, bringing up Manny with bases loaded and no out. Manny rips a grounder to third, and Johnny's off. A-Rod thinks he has a play at home, but he rushes the throw, yanking it to the infield side, and Posada has to lay out to get it, his foot coming off the plate. Johnny's in there, but ump Hunter Wendelstedt punches him out. What? I'm out of my seat and screaming at him, trying to keep my language clean so I don't get kicked out. Trudy's embarrassed, but amused, too. Our neighbor Mason laughs, shaking his head. That's the third horrible call that's gone against us this series. And two were for runs. Bases are still loaded for Nomar. He jumps all over a Contreras fastball and lines a bullet to Matsui in left, too short to score Bellhorn. Two down, and it looks like we're going to blow another opportunity. But Millar, who's been blazing lately, dumps one into center that Lofton can't quite get to. They should have a play on Manny, but it never materializes, and the game's tied. Lowe has no problem with the bottom of their order. Bernie, Tony Clark, and Enrique Wilson will go a combined 1-for-10. And in our half of the second, Contreras hits Mirabelli, gives up a smoked single to Kapler, and then serves up a pretty pesky pole shot to Johnny, the ball rising into the night, then hitting the woven metal skirt of the pole and dropping straight down. We're still celebrating when Bellhorn takes one out. It's 6-2 and only the second inning. Contreras picks up his second hit batsman of the inning when he throws behind Millar. The crowd is pissed and loud. After Friday night's game and how blatant the pitch was, I expect he'll be heaved to keep order. But no, Wendelstedt just issues a warning to both clubs. So the Yanks get two free ones. When a pitch gets through Mirabelli and knocks Wendelstedt's mask off, sending him to one knee, there's a sense of frontier justice. Torrey decides to save the pen and let Contreras hang, and it works for the most part. The unstoppable Millar hits a Coke bottle shot in the fifth, and the two runs we tack on in the sixth are partly reliever Felix Heredia's fault, and partly Matsui's when he gets fooled by a fly to left. Earlier in the series, he got caught too close to the wall, and a ball hopped over his head. Now he plays too far off it, and David Ortiz's slicing fly hits the padding about 5 feet off the ground, and a catchable ball becomes a run-scoring double. Millar singles Ortiz in for his fourth RBI. It's 9-2, and the game's turning into a party. John Kerry's sitting two sections over from us, right by the end of the Sox dugout, along with John Glenn, Joe Biden, Tom Brokaw, Tim Russert, and a gaggle of other Democratic National Convention celebrities. Between innings, the teenage guy sitting in front of us gesture to him with a ball they want signed. Kerry waves it on. The kid's throw is short, hitting Katie Couric. Kerry signs it, and since I'm the only one with a glove, he throws it back to me. When the next half inning's over, I catch Kerry's eye with the ball I snagged from Miguel Cairo and toss it to him, the right distance but wide. I think it's going to bounce onto the field, but Kerry reaches over the wall, stretches, and makes a sweet one-handed grab. I point to him, surprised. He points back and nods. After he signs, his toss is perfect, head high, and again we point at each other. Oil can Boyd and John Kerry in one day. In the top of the seventh, Bellhorn pulls up on a grounder by Kenny Lofton. Lowe gets Jeter.
Zoolander!
And Sheffield.
Juice! Juice! Juice!
But Lofton steals second and A-Rod walks. Lowe's pitch count is around 120, so Francona goes to Timlin, and I go to the bathroom, figuring a 6-run lead is safe. It's quiet in the bathroom. Too quiet, I think. And then there's a cheer. Then nothing. When I get out of the stall, there are maybe five guys at the long line of urinals, and I know something's wrong. When I sidle my way up the ramp, I check the scoreboard. Sox 9, Yanks 6. What happened? I ask Trudy. I go away for 5 seconds and everything goes to hell. Timlin happened, she says. Matsui hit a grand slam. So it's a game again. And the newly acquired Terry Adams, yikes, makes it even more torturous in the eighth by walking number 9 hitter Enrique Wilson, now batting 215. Lofton spanks a double down the right field line, and they have second and third with one out. Fulk comes in to face Jeter, who rips the first pitch off Fulk's shin, and in a very un-Red Sox-like sequence, the ball ricochets directly to the one man who can throw Jeter out, catcher Doug Mirabelli. Mirabelli even has time to glance at third, then guns it to first. The ball hits Jeter in the shoulder and rolls into right. Wendelstedt is on the play immediately, waving both arms to one side, like a football ref signaling a field goal try wide right. It's interference. Jeter's out for running to the infield side of the baseline, purposely trying to block the throw. The runners have to return to their bases. It's the ghost of Ed Armbruster, I say, conjuring up another demon to be exorcised. Joe Torre pads out to argue, but it's pointless. Jeter the cheater finally got busted. The Sox finally got a call, and just in time, too. Sheffield's up next, and smokes a hooking line drive. Right to Manny, and we're out of it. Fulk throws a quick 1-2-3 ninth, the crowd on its feet for every pitch. It's another big win, and after last night, maybe the start of the turnaround we've been waiting for. We're 8-4 against the Yanks on the year, and back in front in the wild card, with Pedro going tomorrow. Let's go, Sox!
July 26th. I rarely in my life wanted to be at Fenway as much as I wanted to be there for the 3-game series between the Red Sox and the Yankees that just concluded. Not because John Kerry threw out the ceremonial first pitch in prime time last night, not because there's always a chance the two teams will go at it, as they did in full bore on Saturday, not even because the atmosphere when these two teams play is always crazy, scary, electric, like Victor Frankenstein's lab about 20 seconds before the monster on the slab opens its eyes. I wanted to be there because it was an absolutely crucial series for the Red Sox if they had to maintain any thin chance of winning the AL East. Lose two, I thought, and the players can probably forget about that part of it. Get swept, and the fans can start questioning the team's commitment to winning anything. Well, wish in one hand, shit in the other. See which one fills up first. I think Mahatma Gandhi said that. Instead of being in Boston, I found myself on the West Coast, 3,000 miles from Fenway Park, speaking to a bunch of doctors about how it feels to get hit by a small van, not good, and how long it takes to get over it. Quite a while. Still, Red Sox fans can't escape the Red Sox. That is the basic fact of our existence. Even in L.A., I went to bed sick at the 8-7 loss on the night of the 23rd. Distance didn't lessen the pain. It made it worse. With no Nesson, I was reduced to the coverage in the Saturday Los Angeles Times, which, due to their ridiculous infatuation with the Dodgers, was skimpy. Still, there was enough to make it clear that Curt Schilling and Keith Falk, our supposed Yankee killers, both played a part in the loss. It's hard to blame Schilling, who all season has worked like a railway yardman in need of overtime and has been consistently effective. It's also hard to blame Falk, but easy to be exasperated with him. I think that goes with the role of closer. And, of course, it had to be Alex Rodriguez, the one who got away, who delivered the game-winning hit. Ironically, it was also Rodriguez who seems to have galvanized the Red Sox since, and all because he couldn't just put his head down and trot to first. Nope, he had to jaw at Bronson Arroyo, who plunked him on the shoulder pad. Jason Veritek got between pitcher and batter, telling A-Rod in a few choice words, Veritek's version, to take his base. Footnote. On the replay, Veritek appears to be saying either, take your fucking base, or get the fuck to first base. Rodriguez told Tech where he could stick his base. Tech pushed A-Rod's pretty face and the rumble was on. By the time it was over, Yankee pitcher Tanyan Sturts had sustained a healthy cut on the side of his face. David Ortiz might have had something to do with that. Four or five players had been ejected, and Varitek ended up sitting out Sunday's game. Probably just as well from a catching standpoint. John Kerry threw out the first pitch, and while he may be a hell of a politician, his slider needs serious work. Can you even trust a politician with a good slider? Just asking. Following the rhubarb, the Donnybrook, and the ejections, the Sox finally woke from their stupor, winning one of the most thrilling games of the year in the bottom of the ninth on a Bill Miller walk-off home run. They won Sunday's game 9-6 and are schooling the Orioles tonight behind Pedro. The score is 12-5 in the bottom of the seventh. If this is the place where the season turns around and stranger things have happened, then you can give Jason Varitek the MVP for getting in Alex Rodriguez's face.
July 27th. Trots on the DL, I discover, having aggravated the quad. The team makes it sound like a brief stay, just to let him rest, and to make room on what's now a crowded roster. Yesterday in Pawtucket, I watched Cesar Crespo play badly, and I wonder if it's the effect of us signing Ricky Gutierrez, knocking Cesar that much further down the depth chart. My neighbor Dave was at the Saturday Brawl game, and says one reason why the fight started wasn't shown on TV. After A-Rod started barking, Bronson Arroyo walked toward home plate, tugging at his crotch. Hey, I got you $252 million right here. July 28th. 3 days from the trading deadline, the papers say the Yanks are close to finalizing a deal for Randy Johnson, and the Twins and Pirates are ready to swap former Rockcat Doug Minkiewicz and Chris Benson. Theo so far has been quiet. Whether that means he's being secretly effective or coming up empty remains to be seen, but it would not bode well if our big midseason acquisition was Terry Adams.
At 45-54, the Orioles are sleepwalking through another disappointing season. You wouldn't know it by the way they've played against the Red Sox, though. Behind Pedro, and still pumped up from beating the Yankees 2 out of 3, we shellacked them 2 nights ago. But the O's batters had touched Tim Wakefield for 4 quick runs last night before the game was washed out. Tonight they got 4 more against Curt Schilling, and sorry, no rain. We are 4-7 so far against Baltimore this year, and I'd love to be able to comfort myself by saying we just play lousy against the Birds. But it ain't so, Joe. The fact of the matter is that the Birds play lousy against the rest of the league and like world champions against us. Schilling, 12-4, against Dave Borkowski, 1-2, was a mismatch on paper. But for the last time, baseball games aren't played on paper. And tonight, Borkowski, who we'd already beaten once this year, pitched like Steve Carlton in his prime, setting down the first 13 Red Sox batters to face him before giving up a single to Nomar in the fifth. He pitched 7 strong and left the game with a 2-hit shutout. The only Boston run came on an Ortiz dinger with 2 out in the ninth, and Javi Lopez, a Red Sox nemesis from his Atlanta Braves days, hit a pair off Schilling, getting 3 of the 4 Baltimore RBIs. So we're a game behind Oakland in the wild card race, and we have the unpleasing prospect of 3 games against the red-hot Minnesota Twins in the immediate future, and 8 more against the O's before the season is over. And if we finish the season series with them at something like 7-12 and lose the wild card by 2 games, we can blame the Birds. Hell, it beats blaming the Bambino.
July 29th. Now the papers say Theo might try to piggyback that Twins-Pirates deal, shipping Euclid to Pittsburgh for Minkiewicz. Just the idea makes me queasy. Trading Lowe or Nomar would be bad enough, even if we have no intention of signing them, but Euk's the future. After what happened with Freddy Sanchez, though he's been hurt the last year or so, they ought to know better. The Sox have a travel day, so to get my daily dose, I take Steph and the boys over to Norwich for a doubleheader against the Trenton Thunder. Like New Britain, Norwich has a pretty little park that holds around 6,000, but the food is better here. I get a ball during warm-ups, and have former Sox closer and current Norwich pitching coach Bob the Steamer Stanley and his former battery mate and current first base coach Roger LaFrancois sign it. The Thunder are the Yanks' double-A club. They used to be ours before we acquired Portland from the Marlins, and the Navigators used to be the Yankees, so for long-term fans there are some mixed, if not to say confused, feelings. But it's camp day, so most of the fans are too young to care. It's a brilliant blue afternoon. Everyone receives a coupon for free ice cream, and as we leave, the ushers hand out flyers telling us Willie Mays is coming next week. Makes me wish I could be here for it. July 30th. It's the big party for Trudy's parents' 50th anniversary, a real production, and I can't get away with the sneaky Pirates radio and earphone. A good half of the guests are New Englanders and diehard Sox fans. The men, mostly, with memories of the 46 Club and the old Braves. To a man, they think Francona is just another patsy. The last manager we had with any spine was Dick Williams. You saw everywhere he went. He was a winner. The women roll their eyes. After the band's packed up, we have a nightcap downstairs in the bar. The TV's silently playing extra innings, and Eric Fried and Sam Horn and Jamie Parker are all smiling, so my guess is we won. The Yanks did, too, and the Rangers. So we're behind the A's again. They also list a pair of big trades. The Mets have won the Benson sweepstakes. Not only that, but in a five-team deal, somehow they also picked up Tampa Bay ace Victor Zambrano and put themselves in a position to win the wimpy NL East. The other trade is an eight-player swap between the Marlins and Dodgers, the principals being Brad Penny and Charles Johnson, Guillermo Mota and Paul LaDuca. No news from Theo. July 31st. The Yankees have reversed themselves on Giambi's intestinal parasite and are now saying he has a benign tumor and may be out for the season. Also, during Fox's Yankee Game of the Week, an announcer says that Trout will miss the rest of the year instead of the week or two the Sox originally reported. If that's true, we're screwed. All of the friends who came to last night's party are here for a day at the beach. And there's a revolving audience for the Yankees-O's game. A-Rod takes home on the back end of a double steal that the Orioles fall for, and for the rest of the day the announcers crow about how A-Rod stole home as if he's Jackie Robinson. I'm just watching the game for any late trade news, since the deadline's almost upon us. Soon it's past 4, no news, and the Yanks are winning, so I go pack my things to drive Steph home for a friend's birthday party.
I get the news from my daughter-in-law, a once-upon-a-time Yankee fan. Like once-upon-a-time Protestants who convert to Catholicism, lapsed Yankee fans who become Red Sox partisans are the ones who really mean business. And she sounds the way I feel, shocked, but somehow not all that surprised. The player most commonly identified with the Boston Red Sox, the one whose number most fans probably expected to see someday up on the wall along with Williams's, Pesky's, and Yaz's, is no longer with the Red Sox. Number 5 has been traded, and probably the only consolation to be taken by fans who place tradition and heart above salary and statistics is that he's been traded to the one other team in baseball whose long World Series drought has become not just the stuff of history, but that of myth. That's right, folks. At game time tomorrow, Nomar Garciaparra, Boston's surviving marquee player from the days of Dan Duquette, will take the field as a Cubby. Does the deal make sense? I don't think so. I think that 2 years from now it will look like a panic move made by a young GM who saw his high-priced and supposedly high-powered baseball team treading water 8 or 9 games behind the monolithic Yankees in the AL East, and a game or two behind the Oakland A's in the wild card, but still more advantageously placed than their closest competition. In other words, I think that Theo Epstein probably pulled the pin on a big deal at the trading deadline, mostly because everyone in Boston's howling, "Oh God, my asshole's on fire" sports community was yelling for it to happen. Oh, geez, before it's too late. What exactly did we get for our usually dependable, sometimes brilliant, and I admit it, at times erratic shortstop who was batting 321 at the time of the trade? We got two Gold Glove infielders, one with a name that can be both pronounced and spelled, that would be Orlando Cabrera, and the other with a name that can at least be pronounced, Doug Mankiewicz. Putting the bat on the little white ball has seemed a little harder than catching it for these gentlemen, at least so far this season. Both are hitting around 250. According to Red Sox general manager Theo Epstein, the fact that Cabrera and Mankiewicz currently have batting averages 70 points below Garcia Parra's doesn't matter. As a disciple of Billy Beane and a follower of Bill James, he likes these men for their defense and their on-base percentage, OBP. Footnote: Mankiewicz did his best to make Epstein look like a genius in his first game as a Red Sox, going 2-for-4, both singles. The second hit came in the top of the ninth against Minnesota, the only pro baseball team he'd ever played for until this evening, in a game which the Twins led by a score of 5-4. He got to second base, into scoring position in other words, before Kevin Youkilis struck out to end the game. The other new Boston players should join the club tomorrow. He also likes them because Nomar Garcia Parra is in the last year of a contract currently paying him $11 million a year, and re-signing him probably would have been Trey expensive. Stories about how Nomar's feelings were hurt during the failed A-Rod deal are probably no more than the usual baseball bullshit. But here's something that isn't. Both Nomar and his agent know that baseball is a business. They also know that an athlete's period of top earning ability is severely limited when compared to, say, that of a corporate CEO or a best-selling novelist. And I have no doubt that Nomar and his man of business were determined to make 'em pay this fall, whoever M turned out to be. Theo Epstein just decided M wasn't going to be us. Does that make sense? I'm sure it does to Theo Epstein. And it probably does to those of the Billy Beane bent. It does, in other words, if you see big league baseball as a business and nothing else. Who it does not make sense to is my 5-year-old grandson, who was watching ESPN when SportsCenter announced the trade. Ethan is a big Nomar fan. He always pretends to be Nomar when he's hitting in the backyard, when he's throwing, when he's running the bases. So it's Ethan I'm thinking about as I write this. Not his mother, the converted Yankee fan, not Nomar himself, not even the Red Sox, the putative subject of this book. Nope, I'm just thinking about Ethan. Nomar's a Cub, he said, then watched the TV for a while. Then very softly he said, I guess I like the Cubs. Good call, Ethan. Very good call.
I've just finished my goodbyes when my sister-in-law says I've got a phone call. It's Steve. They traded Nomar, he says. Ah, shit, I say, partly because they fooled me. It's almost 5 o'clock. I thought I was safe. To the Cubs. I think we got their shortstop and maybe a pitcher. Alex Gonzalez is a decent shortstop, and we've been looking at starter Matt Clement, maybe to take Arroyo's place or to assume the middle role. I relay the news to the boys, and they switch back to the game. Steph runs in. We got Cabrera and Mankiewicz. So it was a 3-team deal. So Nomar's gone to Red Sox West, Steve says. My 5-year-old grandson's been in tears. But I still like Nomar, he says. I guess I'm a Cubs fan now. I think we must have gotten Clement, since our real need is middle relief. But Steve can't find anything on the website. Nomar for Mankiewicz and Orlando Cabrera of the Expos. So it's a 4-team deal. It doesn't seem like enough. And we've already got 3 first basemen and 3 journeyman shortstops. It must have been a panic move on Theo's part, dumping Nomar before he could walk. It's just like the Yawkeys, not wanting to pay a star top dollar and getting nothing for him. While I'm still on the phone, Steph tells me the Yanks have gotten last year's Cy Young runner-up Esteban Loaiza from the White Sox for Jose Contreras. It's a steal, even with George's $3 million thrown in, a panic move on Chicago's part that doubly benefits the Yanks. So we got hosed on both deals. Steve's off to see the Village. I'm off to drive 100 miles. After I hang up, I feel like the season's over, like we've given up. On the road, we tune into ESPN Radio, and hear that we got speedster Dave Roberts from the Dodgers for outfielder Henry Stanley, who just signed balls for us in Pawtucket on Monday. It's a good deal, but not large enough to make up for the loss of Nomar. The Sox without Nomar. It seems like a defeat, whoever's fault it is. During the pregame, Theo talks about how we needed to fix our defense, as if that's what drove the deal. Then, because we have nowhere else to put him, we start Millar in right, even though Kapler's been hot. Steph notes that the music behind his highlights from last night is Tenacious D's Wonder Boy. The game is anticlimactic after the video of Nomar leaving the clubhouse for the airport. The announcers, all of them paid by the Sox, put the best face on the deal they can, picking at Nomar's attitude and his heel. Where's Eck when you need him? Cooperstown being inducted. Lowe throws okay, so does Radke. The biggest moment is when Doug Minkiewicz steps to the plate for the first time in a Red Sox uniform. Minkiewicz is a lifelong Twin, and the Metrodome rises and gives him a noise meter worthy ovation. He has to step out to collect himself, and I realize we never had a chance to say goodbye to Nomar. We didn't know it, but that Sunday night game against the Yanks was his last home game. It's a close game late, tied in the eighth, when Embry comes in with one down and the bases empty to face lefty Jacques Jones. He gets behind him, then aims a fastball. Jones cranks it, flipping his bat away. The ball lands 10 rows back. Joe Nathan, throwing 98, closes with the help of Francona. Minkiewicz, 2 for 4, singles to open the inning. Kapler pinch runs. Millar, who should be bunting, swings away. On an 0-1 count, Kapler goes, and Henry Blanco guns him by 10 feet. Millar flies out. It's a terrible at-bat on all counts, an embarrassment. Bill Miller then steps in and pulls a long shot down the line, foul. He singles. It would have easily scored Kapler. Then takes second on a wild pitch before Euclid strikes out. Overall, just a tough day to be a Red Sox fan. Seems like everywhere we turned, we did something stupid and got our asses kicked. There are 60 games left, and we're pretty much where we were last year. It's time to put a stretch drive together. Or else.